Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan sitting in for Joe today, and I want to go straight to Kelly Tallant. Kelly, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
How are you, Kelly?
I'm good. I'm in hospital, but I'm going home
tomorrow. That line isn't the best. Will we stick with it? I'm just trying to get the nod up here. You're in hospital at the moment, Kelly?
Yeah, I'm in Vincent Hospital.
Okay, I think we're hearing you a bit better now. And you have a rare lung disease.
Yeah, it's a really rare lung disease. So I go into hospital about 3-4 times a year and just require IV antibiotics for an infection. So this would be the first hospital admission this year. But last year I would have done about 4.
Okay, but it's what you're given to eat in hospital that has...
Yeah, it's appalling. Like, the food that you're given here is so bad that I wouldn't even give it to my dog. Like, the other day, I got a lasagna with what looked like mashed up peas inside it with a side of mashed potatoes, and it looked like frozen veg that was, like, so cooked that the nutrition was, like, boiled out of it.
Okay, lasagna. I know people have a lot of ways in which to eat their lasagna, but that doesn't sound like the best one.
It was just like a big slob on a plate, like looking. I think my dog would reject it as well, and it hasn't been the first time. Like, I do hospital admissions all the time in this hospital, so it wouldn't be the first time, like, where you'd be able to lift up a plate and the food would literally be stuck to the plate, or else it's just like in a slob of grease.
And of course, I mean, it's not the catering staff's fault that delivered to you, but would they have an apologetic look on their face when they'd put it down before you?
Not really. Like, I remember just the caterer came in, like, it's not their fault, like, they're just there for the food. He came in, he was like, you're not eating that. And I was like, would you eat it? And he just walked out of the room. He just didn't say anything.
Yeah, I mean, there have been reports about the amount of hospital food that is not eaten. Up to 49% of hospital food is actually food waste, they say. You think that's because people...
It's just the amount of money I spend in hospital is, like, I'd spend at least, like, for, say, a two-week hospital admission, I'd spend about 200-250 euros on food alone, because I just order takeaways, because it's the only kind of food that would be edible.
So you order takeaways to your hospital bed?
So I order them, and then I just go down to reception to collect them. Like, thankfully, I'd be well enough to walk around, but, like, other people wouldn't necessarily be well enough to walk around. But thank God I've got, like, apps on my phone where I can just order food, and they just ring me when they leave the restaurant. So I just walk down to reception and collect it, and just pay with their card.
Is there many people doing that, do you think?
A lot. Everyone I know who comes into hospital regularly would do that, where they just order food through their phone.
Would the food you'd be ordering be healthier than the food that you're being served in the hospital?
A bit more appealing. Like, last night I got an Eddie Rockets, which was a little bit more appealing than a bit of slob on the plate.
Although I don't know, would Eddie Rockets be...
It's not necessarily more nutritional value, but it's a little bit more something that you'll eat. Like, that could be the only thing you'll eat for the whole day.
Have you seen any improvement at all? As you say, you've had reason to be in hospital.
I actually looked at a photo. I looked at a photo that I put up on Twitter 4 years ago, and it was spaghetti bolognese, and I was appalled by the state of the food 4 years ago. And I was like, looking at that photo only today, I was like, the difference 4 years later, like, that there's no difference.
I see here a report from August 2017. So what's that now? 3.5, coming up on 4 years ago. The HSE has hired a dietitian to help oversee improvements in the standard of food on offer at Irish hospitals for staff as well as patients. It says that the Department of Health is undertaking an effort to improve the quality of food at hospitals, and current minister, then former minister now, of course, Simon Harris, highlighted it as a priority in one of his first speeches upon taking over the role as Minister for Health. You say nothing has changed in the hospital you're in, at least?
No, I can't see any improvement at all.
Actually, I'm looking down at this report, Kelly, and it's saying that the study by HICWA, the Health Information and Quality Authority, found that 86% of the patients they spoke to were happy with how they were fed while in hospital, but they did identify a number of areas for improvement. 86% are happy, says this report, Kelly.
Well, what I would order, the only thing I'd be happy with would be the simple stuff to order, would be salad with eggs on it. That piece of food that I ordered you today was like a piece of slob.
Yeah, and I'm so you'd be so aware as well that when you're in hospital, your appetite might not be the best anyway for, you know, for some circumstances. So you might be even more sensitive to how food looks and tastes.
Yeah, like I haven't had much of an appetite in about 10 days because someone handed me that. I think that would be okay.
Okay, I'm afraid that line is breaking down on us again. If you want to hang on there, Kelly, we might get a better line for you. And I want to bring in Gillian McNulty. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Gillian, you also, unfortunately, have reason to spend some time in hospital.
Yeah, I have cystic fibrosis and, like Kelly, I attend symptoms at hospital. Now, last year I would have been quite ill and had to be in two admissions for almost 3 months each. And the food is absolutely appalling. I mean, it was so bad last April, May and June and July. I was in for those months and I would end up in tears most days, either at tea or lunch, even breakfast.
Okay.
I
was going to say, talk me through the day then, food-wise, because you spent very long periods in hospital, which would be difficult anyway in any circumstances. But obviously, food, which, if I have memory from any time I had to be in hospital, is it's the one break in the day, so it's like something is happening, the food is arriving. But so talk me through, what would be your typical breakfast?
Well, patients on the CF ward do have a bit of a choice, because our calories are so, so important. People with cystic fibrosis need a high-calorie, high-fat diet. So we're allowed a choice, which we're kind of very lucky. So we're given, each evening, we're given a sheet for our choice of breakfast or lunch. Breakfast comes in at about 7:30, and you could have cereal and toast or a boiled egg. I'm allowed a boiled egg because I'm in renal failure, so I can't have cereal or milk. So I'm allowed a boiled egg and toast. Now, for instance, most days, like they bring in your breakfast, your toast would be stone cold or the boiled egg would be cold. The tea would be lukewarm. So straight away, like you're starting off bad. Then lunch, same thing, like your lunch could come in. If it was any way edible, it will not be warm. But most days I just took a look at it and just cried. You know, you'd order chicken and you could literally bounce it off the wall. The potatoes would be lumpy and cold. One day I'd ordered stew. I can remember particularly that I'd ordered a lamb stew, which is actually really nice. The stew in here is beautiful. But because I'm on a renal diet, I'm very restricted on vegetables and stuff like that. And literally, like, the plate was about a small spoon of stew and the rest was carrots and peas. And it's just like, I can't eat this. And for the bit of stew that I got, it wouldn't fill me. And then tea comes, and it's the same thing. They'll get the wrong order, and then it's like, tough, well, sorry, the kitchen's closed. So, you know, most days my brother ended up bringing me in a takeaway, which isn't ideal, but it was better than nothing. I mean, at one stage when I was in last year, my weight dropped to 38 kilos. Like, I was really, really ill and really, really skinny.
38 kilos? What height are you, Gillian?
I'm 5'2.5".
So you were, that's very, very low weight.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, I was very ill, but the fact that the food was so bad as well, I couldn't eat.
And was this something that was discussed with your medical team, the fact that you were finding it difficult to eat the food that was being presented to you?
Yeah, they all knew. And to be honest, I actually asked to speak to the managers from the kitchen, and they came up to me, and they came up 3 or 4 different times and said, look, we'll change things, you know, and they brought up new menus and asked me to pick what patients should be getting. We discussed it in length one day for nearly 2 hours. And things initially changed, but like within a couple of weeks, things were just the very same. Your food was cold. The food that they were bringing just one look at it and you'd almost be sick. It was just, you'd get spaghetti bolognese, which I actually don't eat anything with mint here because it just looks like cat food and there's grease all over the place. You order, say, spaghetti bolognese and you get bolognese with fusilli pasta, for instance. You don't actually get spaghetti, you know. So I ended up having to order dry spaghetti on its own or rice because that's all I could eat because you couldn't eat anything else.
Let me, I think Kelly's back on. I think we have you on a better line. Kelly, can you hear us now?
Yeah, hear me.
What did you get for lunch today?
I got an egg salad.
How was that?
Like, it wasn't delicious. Like, so there was like a turkey slices on it that literally looked like just really slimy. I can't even describe it, like jelly hanging off it. I have now a dietitian coming up to me today just to give supplements, just to keep me going for the next few days. If I'm going to be here for the next few days, just to give some sort of nutrition because I haven't been able to touch the food.
And again, do your doctors know that you're having this issue then?
Oh, yeah, they do. Sure, like the last time I've been here, I had the same issue with food, like cooked.
I'm so sorry, Kelly. Kelly, I'm so sorry. We're really having trouble with that line again. Yeah. We'll see if we can sort it. I think Gillian is still on the line. Are you still there, Gillian?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Yeah. What Kelly is saying, they're very, very familiar to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been attending Vincent's for almost 30 years, and it's never changed. I mean, it really is a disgrace what patients are handed up. Especially patients that are really sick and need proper nutrition. You're not getting it here. The veg are frozen and half the time they're boiled so much that every ounce of nutrition is going to be gone out of it.
Yeah, well, I don't think frozen is an issue there at all because I think frozen actually maintains nutrition in veg, but I suppose, yeah, overcooking might.
Overcooked. It's just, it's really, really bad.
And I think it's fair to say that this is an issue. And as we said there from that report that was from 2017, this is an issue right across the hospital system. You know, with some honourable exceptions, but this is something that people joke about. But I suppose it's no joke if, like yourself or like Kelly, you have reason to. This is your only source of nutrition for long periods of time.
Yeah, and I would be used to when I come into hospital, there's a small shopping centre across the road. I could go over and get my lunch or my tea, whatever. But last year, during April, May, June and July, there was restrictions with COVID. So we weren't allowed to leave our rooms. We weren't allowed visitors into the hospital. So you're relying on family or friends to drop food at the door and then just go. You know, like my friends did bunch together and they all got me Just Eat vouchers and stuff like that. They were amazing. So I had enough money to be able to get takeaways. And my brother brought me in a lot of food. But there's so many people that don't have money to be able to afford takeaways because it actually really adds up. I think I spent €900 when I was in here for the couple of months on takeaways so that I wouldn't starve to death. And that's not right.
I wonder, is this an Irish, particularly Irish issue, or is this a universal problem with hospital food around the world?
I've seen people around the world, like I have friends from every corner of the world with cystic fibrosis, and, you know, you would see some of the hospitals. Now, some places are amazing, but there's others that it's pure slop that patients are being handed. And something has to give here because they're not thinking of patients. It's not right.
Stay there, Gillian. I've got Hannah on another line. Hannah, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
It's not just adult hospitals, you're saying?
No, unfortunately, it's the same in children's hospitals. Unfortunately, I've had to spend time in both Tala and Crumlin with my son, and the food is just vile, really, to be perfectly honest. I know that's a strong word, but it's just really substandard. You would never be offered a piece of fruit. I actually took out looking for a piece of fruit. You know, you'd never see a piece of fruit coming from anybody. Just various rehashings of minced, soggy waffles, disgusting pieces of bacon, just greasy, just really substandard food when you think that there are young children in there trying to recover from various ailments. And, yeah, it's just really disappointing and not good enough, really.
I suppose the one of the issues here is that it's a massive catering operation, obviously, to feed however many hundreds or thousands, you know, of patients every day that have to get their food hot, hopefully, at the same time.
Yeah.
Go on, Hannah.
No, I was going to say we rarely saw any hot food coming in. This was both pre-COVID and during COVID, and unfortunately the experience was no different. I suppose really when you think of what food is nutritious, I mean, I understand the logistics in creating so many meals for so many people must be very, very difficult and very, very complicated, but it shouldn't be too hard to get healthy meals to and nutritious meals to people who are recovering, be they adults or children. I mean, they're there to recover. So if you're serving them a couple of greasy rashers and a soggy waffle that's been sitting in a carton for about 2 hours, then you're not promoting recovery. They want people out of hospitals as soon as possible and recovered, and they should be providing food that gives people vitamins and minerals and the nutrients they need, you know, not the slop that is given.
Yeah, and of course, if your child is in hospital, you're in hospital as well. Basically, you're stuck there, so you can't be bringing in nutritious meals from the kitchen at home.
No, we did. You know, we used to try. Thankfully, if I had anything in the freezer, we would bring in what we could. You know, and I know it's the same for babies. I had a friend who was in Crumlin recently, and she was just given like these jars of baby food. And I know it must be very, very difficult for the hospital to arrange baby food, but you know, it's just. Yeah, I just don't think it's good enough. Like, we used to just stock up on breakfast and get cereal and toast and then hope for the best. You know, sometimes we would just end up having plain pasta because what else was on offer was just, you know, you wouldn't eat it. As the other lady said, I wouldn't give it to my dog. And I don't know who the 86% of people are saying they were happy with the food. I'm sure that survey was given to them on their way out of the hospital. And at that point, you're just so relieved to go home. You don't want to complain about anything at that point.
Indeed, yeah. I'm just looking at that report again. One of the issues was that there was very little detail about food choices. In many cases, meals were described as chicken or fish with no further detail about how the meat was cooked, whether it was fried, baked or stewed, or about side dishes such as vegetables or sauces. That all sounds like you're in a restaurant ordering, but that sounds very far away from the experiences that that you've had and that Gillian and Kelly had. And there's also talk about, of course, the various, that's another whole issue, of course, choices for various ethnic, religious or cultural backgrounds. Stay there, Hannah. I've got Mary Cotter. Mary, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You were just out of hospital.
I'm about 10 days home now after spending 5 days in James Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown. And I was listening to the programme and I felt, well, it's only fair that I asked them would they like to hear my experience in James Connolly.
Because it's very different.
It is different. It is really, really different. Now, if my family were listening to this show, I don't know whether they are or not, they would say, good God, sure, my mother's the most fussy person about her dinner.
Right, Mary.
And I am. So it isn't easy to please me.
Right.
But I must say that my experience in Connolly was good. I wouldn't say I was in a 4 or 5 star hotel, but it was good. Every day you got a choice. And I just give two examples of a dinner. First of all, breakfast was, I think, the usual, a choice of cereal or a boiled egg.
Right.
That was okay. I don't go for cereals that much, and I took a hard boiled egg and I took toast, and that was fine. But at dinner time, I thought, oh God, what am I going to do? I've never eaten food in a hospital before. And because normally my family would be able to bring me in alternative stuff. But two examples. The first meal I got was ham and vegetable, very tasty little vegetable, and two little pats of very tasty mashed potato. And the ham was very tough, now, to be honest. So I thought, oh God, this is what it's going to be like. But the next day then I got roast beef, and I would only use fillet of beef in my house. But I got roast beef that was tender and tasty and really nice. And on two occasions in the evening meal, I got a salad as good as I would make myself, a very mixed salad.
Wow.
Now, desserts were usually ice cream and jelly. I don't eat jelly, but I would have enjoyed the little ice cream. But then I was diagnosed with diabetes. And when she came with the ice cream, she said, oh, your ice cream. And I said, no, I can't have it. I have diabetes now. And she said, well, wait a minute. So she went off and came back with a bowl of delicious fruit salad.
Wow.
So. And I noticed other people in the room with me. And if they didn't like what they got, you know, they weren't in the room or didn't think I'd ordered that, they'd say, well, do you know what I have? Would you like that? They couldn't have been nicer. they couldn't have been nicer or more caring. Not only the catering staff, of course, the nursing staff were excellent and the carers. They really were. It's a hospital, if you have to go into hospital, try and get into Conwy.
Right, okay, that's a fantastic ringing endorsement from you there, Mary. And obviously, so I suppose the word is it can be done. It's not an impossibility.
It can be done. So I would love, I don't know whether one can research that, I would love to know how one hospital like Connolly can produce a quite nice little dinner or evening meal and why other hospitals can't.
Okay, I think we might have found another hospital that can. Bear with us. Seamus Downey, good afternoon.
Aidan, how are you doing? How are things?
You were in Tullamore Hospital.
I was in Tullamore Hospital for, I'd say, probably about 6 weeks of the last 8 weeks.
And you had no issue with the food there?
No, it was lovely. I'd wake up in the morning waiting for it. I was that hungry, you know. And because I was on steroids, and I was going mad with the hunger.
Oh yeah, the steroids really do up your appetite, don't they? Yeah. And so give us an idea. What would you be presented with for breakfast?
Breakfast in the morning now is toast. So, you know, toast, brown bread, and a choice of your own cereals, whatever you wanted. Rice Krispies or cornflakes or the likes of that.
Okay, and lunch?
And lunch, then you'd get a cup of tea around 11:30. In the morning, if you wanted to, and you could get, if you didn't want tea, you could get soup. They'd give you soup in the morning.
Right.
And lunch then, you'd have roast beef, chicken, with all the vegetables, all that, and plus your dessert, whatever you wanted for dessert. There was usually a choice of desserts as well.
And all hot and fresh. And
yeah, lovely, lovely. Yeah. Lovely.
And then your tea?
Tea was cold meat salad. You could get the chips, sausages, beans, and egg.
Right.
And then you'd get a cup of tea then with biscuits at, say, about 7:30 or whatever.
Right. Oh, I see here. You were in hospital for a long time, Seamus.
I was indeed, yeah. I was indeed. Unfortunately, I have a long-term illness, so I'm in and out.
Right. But this was not a problem for you, or actually a good part of every day.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's Tullamore Hospital. Okay.
That's Tullamore, and its staff are very, very nice. Like, I told them I was hungry and I wasn't getting enough food, and they doubled up my portions.
Right.
They were that nice. They'd go, they'd get you extra. If you wanted something extra, they'd go, just go down and get it for you. No issues at all.
So it was like being in a hotel for you.
Oh, it was. It was like being in a hotel for me. He's right, yeah. It was lovely. Now, I used to look forward to the food.
Right.
That's how nice it was, Keelan.
Okay.
Yeah, my mum actually, this is Gillian, my mum had not a great experience, obviously. She was in Mullingar Hospital 2 years ago, unfortunately. But the food there was amazing. I mean, yeah. I was there with mum during mealtimes and like that. If mum was hungry or wanted anything extra, they'd bring it to her. The food was piping hot. They'd get, like, tea and sandwiches at night before bed. I mean, anything she wanted.
And that's a big hospital, isn't it?
Yeah,
Mullingar.
That's a massive hospital, and they were a credit. Like, they were brilliant. The food was amazing. Mum never had a complaint about it. And neither did I, because I got a shock when I seen some of the food coming sometimes. It's like, oh my God, it actually looked gorgeous.
Yeah, same.
It can be done.
Okay, so the message so far is, if you need to go to hospital, go to the Midlands. If you if you want to eat, the Midlands is the way to go. Where else do we go? Let me bring in Anne. Anne Tormey, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie, how are you? Thank you for the call.
Where were you in hospital?
I was in hospital in Cam. I had hip replacement last year. I was trying to have it in Ireland, but there was a 9-month wait. Here there was a 2-week wait.
In
and
France.
I didn't have anybody to visit me or any fun, but I decided just go for it. The pain was terrible. But the food, I wanted to talk to you about the food. The way they organise it here, there are two hospitals and two clinics in Cam, in the Cam area. Now, when I say the Cam area, I'm talking a 20-kilometre radius. So the food is done, not the breakfast. The breakfast was phenomenal. You got what you wanted. The breakfast was absolutely phenomenal every day. The food is cooked by a company for the two clinics and the two hospitals. And a different menu is arranged every day. And, of course, they have special food for people with special needs. I didn't have special needs. Hip replacement doesn't affect your appetite. So when it comes to the hospital, it's heated. It, it every patient's food is heated individually. I never saw a dessert in that hospital. Every dessert was a beautiful piece of seasonal fruit and a yogurt. You know, in my case, it was in September, it was all strawberries and raspberries and, you know, really like what you'd have at home.
Yeah, that kind of sounds like almost airplane food. That's
yeah,
a great,
that's
but the idea of it being
French gourmet restaurant food, and the portions were not particularly large, which is good when you're lying in bed and you can't move. Do you know what I mean? But lunch was a 2-course meal and dinner was a 4-course meal.
Yeah, well, you were in France, of course, where they do regard food in a slightly different way to the rest of us.
Yeah, but this was a public hospital, Katie. It was a public hospital. It wasn't a private hospital.
Right.
Because I believe a friend of mine was recently in the matter private, and he said the food was phenomenal.
Yes, well, of course.
Absolutely phenomenal. Almost would go back there just for the food.
Right.
So, I rest my case in terms of, but it's stupid, I heard your statistic. I was helping out a little bit with the jabs today, locally, and we all got them here in January. I got mine in January. But, you know, I heard you say that 48% of the food is thrown out.
49%.
Oh,
well, between 30-something and 49%, I think they reckoned, was food waste.
Don't the people, doesn't the HSE and the people who manage the hospital see that?
Indeed. I mean,
that's, Katie, that's your taxpayers' money. I pay my taxes in Ireland. That's the taxpayers' money.
Yes, where am I reading this from now? This is from August 2019. It says, the HSE has said it's committed to reducing food waste in Irish hospitals as research shows that up to 49% of food provided to patients is not eaten. Indeed. I mean, that is a huge waste and on all sorts of levels, obviously.
And I'll tell you something else. When you go into a public hospital, this is my first time in hospital in France, and my first time in hospital for many, many, many years, they come and ask you what you like and what you don't like and are you allergic to anything before you get your first meal. And the breakfast is served. The breakfast was the best coffee. I can't even make the espresso as well at home. The best coffee and a hot croissant.
Okay.
Now, I'm not big into croissant. I prefer something a little less sweet. But it was just a delicious start to the day.
Absolutely. You're making me want to go to hospital in Cannes myself.
Come over here to go to hospital. No, but I just was so sad to listen to people. And also, I'll tell you something else. No visitors are allowed to bring in food. You cannot bring in food, food or flowers, books, yes, you know. And this is, not because of COVID. Just no food because there might be bacteria in the food and the hospital might be blamed for making the patient ill or affecting their digestive system.
Okay, and as you know, as we were hearing from Gillian and Kelly, they say they're only surviving because of the food that they're bringing in themselves.
And look at the money they're spending.
Exactly. I mean, what was Kelly saying there? Up to 200 euro.
I think one woman said 900.
Yeah, I was there for almost 4 months, so I
That's
would have
Gillian,
I
yeah.
a phenomenal amount. Yeah,
that's incredible.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, maybe I hate the gilets jaunes and I hate the way the French behave and they don't give a damn about COVID, but they speak up. We Irish have to speak up and say, you know, we're not going to accept this. We're paying our taxes, paying into health plans. We want edible food, hot.
Yeah.
Okay, but stay there, Irene. Irene, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie, how are you?
I'm good. You were in the Beacon Hospital.
Yeah, that's right, in December. And I'm vegetarian and I thought being in the private hospital that the food would be top class, but it was absolutely disgusting. I sent you in some photographs of the meals that I was given. One consisted of a bowl of rice with a drizzle of soy sauce in it.
That was that was your lunch or your dinner?
It was my main meal, yeah. I sent you a photograph of that. And then another one was two of those, you know, those potato croquettes that you buy in a freezer packet.
Yeah.
Two of those with some peas and carrots, which tasted like they'd come out of a bag of frozen food as well.
God, that's like the bad old days before vegetarianism was recognised by the restaurants of Ireland, isn't it? Where you asked for a vegetarian meal and you got the vegetables that everyone else got and nothing else.
Yeah, well, I think it was even better back then, but it was just, I couldn't believe it. The food was just appalling. Like, and I was living off the yogurts, and I was storing the yogurts so that if I got hungry, and then one of the catering staff spotted that I had some set aside, and he said I wasn't allowed to do that because of COVID restrictions. So that put a stop to that. Luckily,
I have them here. I have them. I've been sent in your the photo. Oh my God!
Yeah.
The bowl of rice is some. That was your meal. It's just literally a bowl of rice with a bit of soy sauce through it.
That's it. Yeah, yeah. It was the worst I've ever seen.
The pasta. What's that green flex on the pasta?
I don't know. I never found out. I just left it behind. It was dried up pasta with something. I don't know what. I don't even know what was put on it.
Though you were paying a lot of money to be where you were.
Well, that's what. And I assumed the food would be top class, but no, you're looking at the evidence there.
And did you give out about it at the time?
I didn't. I didn't feel in the best of form as it was. So I was just eating whatever fruit was there and yogurts. And I'd have a nibble of whatever just to see what it tasted like. But luckily, a friend of mine dropped in some lovely banana bread that she baked and a few bags of goodies. So
it kept you going.
My husband couldn't come over either. So I was just stuck with what I had there. So, was my experience at the private hospital, so it's not any better than public. Like, public probably sounds better.
It depends on what hospital you're in, it seems, from what we're hearing today, that there is a big, big gap between the quality of food available depending on what hospital you find yourself in. Let me bring in Joyce Timmins. Joyce, good afternoon.
Hi. Hi, Katie. How are you?
Good, good. You used to be a chef in a hospital.
I was. I was the exec chef in the Rotunda Hospital for 2 years. I'm now the catering manager in Marymount Care Centre for our elderly.
And what was your attitude towards the food when you were the executive chef in the Rotunda?
Yeah, well, my attitude for the food was that it was to be nice. It was tasty, it was nutritious, it was fresh. It was made on the day for the day and served. And we had two choices for lunch, and we had two choices for tea time. There were salads available. If people wanted salads, they could have salads. But we had a vegetarian dish and a meat dish and condiments. Like, we'd have pickled cucumber, tzatziki with curries. Everything was complemented. Each garnish was complementing the dish, and it was all fresh. And there was a lot of passion that went into the food, and pride that went into the food. And I think that's even as important as the ingredients you're getting in. So you have to have a team that want to make the change and make a change.
Presumably you have to begin with, you have to have the proper budget for it.
You do, but every hospital, I would guarantee, is getting food from Palace or BWG.
These are the big mass catering companies.
Yeah, and they're getting the same chicken, they're getting probably the same mince, the same beef, same fish, you know. So it's not about the budget. I really don't believe it's about budget. It's about caring and really believing in what you're doing, and that the food is there to help. Like, I don't necessarily believe it's medicine, but I do think it helps recovery, most definitely. And it gives you that few minutes of peace and a nice time for you at meal time. Most people going into hospital dread hospital food. Shouldn't be that way. And it's an easy fix, I believe.
Well, that's what Seamus was saying, of course, there, that he was in hospital for a long number of weeks, a long haul. And he found that those meals, which he really enjoyed, they were his break in the day. They were his...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Was there a concerted effort, Joyce, when you were in the kitchen in the Rotunda to improve matters? And was there, you know, what was this something that you were working on constantly? Was it a hospital policy?
Well, there was never an exec chef in the rotunda, so they obviously wanted to make that change and improve things. So that was, it wasn't necessarily a policy. It was what the team, the whole team in the rotunda believed in. They wanted to give the best, and that's what we did. And we developed menus. We simplified the whole kitchen with menus. There was no difference between private food or public food, except they were served different plates. But everybody got the same food, and that was important to me as an exec chef and my team.
Were you ever in hospital yourself, Joyce?
I was in. The only time I was really in was for having my own daughter in a different maternity hospital. And my sister used to bring food up to me, and vice versa. I'd bring food up to her.
When were you executive chef in the rotunda, can I ask you?
2 years ago.
Because I can tell you, I had my own children in the rotunda, and I spent some time in hospital because of that. And I don't remember it being the most fantastic culinary experience of my life at that stage. Mm-hmm. But that's some years ago now.
Yeah. So, well, I'm happy to hear that I did improve things. I'll take that.
And the food that you serve is even calorie counted.
You would put it through. We most hospitals, HSE hospitals, use a system called nutritics, and you put everything into that. You put your recipe, your everything, all your ingredients, your methods, your recipe, everything, and it will come out at the end and tell you everything, the nutritional value, the allergens that were in that dish, everything. So all hospitals should be using that. But I always believe that an exec chef team is needed within the HSC, and to tackle that and to go to each hospital and implement a 4-week menu cycle, that every hospital is using the same menu, has been trained the same way, the same ingredients, the same plate up, everything is the same. And that team spends 3 weeks, a month with a hospital, and then moves on. Now, the teams can be broken up so that you're covering the whole of Ireland. And then they backtrack after another month back to the first hospital to see how they're getting on, any questions, how's it going, and work with the team. You're not there to tell them what to do. You work with the team. And I think that's the way it should be done. Everything is costed, everything is allergened, calorie counted, nutritional value, everything.
Okay. Okay, well, Joyce, we wish you luck in that mission. And it's obviously badly needed in some hospitals, not all. But we'll leave that one there and we'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Now, the Liveline team are still inundated with calls and texts and emails from women who are speaking, many of them for the very first time in their lives, about their experience of menopause. Extraordinary stories that I took over the airwaves last week, and we want to return to that now because, as I say, this is something that so many people really want out there and discussed. And I want to go to Jane. Jane, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to tell my story.
Well, thank you for getting in touch, Jane. Tell us your story. You are, can I ask, what age in life you're at now?
Yes, I'm 54 years old now. Obviously, my story dates back to about 11 years ago. It started since about I was 41 to 44. I started to feel a little bit not myself. I had the old hot flush every now and again. And then I felt a little bit of brain fog one day. And I had a day I was feeling very depressed. But it wasn't all of the time, and I wasn't really paying that much attention. But I think the big, when my whole life crashed, really was around May, June 2010, which is when I really, really started to feel really, really bad, depressed and tearful, angry. I put on a lot of weight as well. And now I sweat. Sorry, Katie.
I was going to say, you were quite young to be experienced those symptoms. Did you put it down to, were you, you know, familiar with perimenopause and what those symptoms might be?
Yeah, I kind of thought it could be perimenopause, but I didn't really give a second thought because it wasn't constant before, like I say, April or May 2010. I didn't really think much of it at the time. But then it got much worse, which is when I started having the day and night sweats, and I just started to hate everything and being miserable for no reason. With my husband, obviously, I made his life miserable as well, and I was miserable myself, bottom line. And it was just a really, really tough time for me, and I'm sure it was for him, and I'm sure it was for many people who knew me, my friends, my family, and everyone. At work as well, I couldn't concentrate. I started sweating. I had brain fog, forgetting things when I always did a great job before. So I really, really struggled at the time.
How did your boss at work respond to that? Was there support there?
Well, to be honest with you, I didn't even know I was going through the perimenopause. He was my boss at the time, and he did say, well, get your act together. What's wrong with you? You've always done a great job. What's wrong with you? And he was right. He was just doing his job. But I just didn't know what was happening to me. And I think my mistake was, rather than not going then in May, because I eventually went to my fantastic GP, who straight away did an FSH test and did a thyroid test. Well, I just guess it was something related to my thyroid. And then she obviously diagnosed that I was going through the perimenopause due to the FSH test results, and she advised the HRT at the time. But that happened 5 months later, when I've already kind of ruined the relationship with my husband, pretty much.
And did it really ruin your relationship? You really believe that your mood swings were what ruined that relationship?
I really think so, Katie, because before that, I adored the man. He is a fantastic person, and he's a fantastic husband. We were together for 18 years before that happened. Of course, no relationship is blissful forever. You do argue every now and again, but not to the extent of that hatred about him and about everything else, you know? So, yeah, the answer to your question, Katie, it probably is yes, definitely. Had I taken the HRT before, I probably would be still with him.
Wow. And how long is it since you separated?
Yeah, we separated. I moved out of the marital home in November 2010.
And did you go on and get divorced?
Eventually I left the country. I moved to England, but we divorced in 2012.
But it sounds like you have huge regrets now, Jane.
I do, because obviously you get on with your life, as you know, Katie, and I'm happy now. I was happy in Ireland, and I'm happy in England now. But that's after tough years since that happened, because it just shouldn't have happened. I should have got these sources before. Had I gone 5 months earlier, I would have realized. Because that's the thing, Katie, as well. I was saying to your researcher earlier, it was about 2 or 3 days I started my treatment with the HRT. I was a completely different person.
Wow, it was that dramatic.
Absolutely. I have no sweats. No, I was just coming, my weight went, because that's what I needed. I needed the estrogen. I got my periods back because I was too young not to have them. I was told by the GP. I mean, my GP was fantastic. And we're talking as well 11 years ago, where the HRT, it was a little bit more scary, because I was scared. I was reluctant to take it. And she advised me to say,
that you needed it.
Yeah, absolutely. Take it. Life is too short. You need to be happy. Take it. Yeah.
Tell me, have you had this conversation with your ex-husband?
No, I have never had. We have kept in touch. We get in touch a few years after, but obviously I left the country, which is a little bit more difficult, and I don't do Facebook or anything like that. So, eventually I lost touch with him and his family and common friends as well. So, I never had the opportunity to tell him I'm really sorry, and I really wasn't myself back in 2010. And no, I did not hate you. I loved you.
He might be listening.
Oh, he has gone mad.
He might be listening, Jane.
He may be listening, yeah. And I hope he is. I really hope he is.
Would you want to rekindle anything? Do you think there's anything left there now?
No, I think I don't think so. I think it's after 11 years. I did at the beginning, though. I did over the past, after we broke up, probably 3 or 4 years after, I kind of thought, yeah, it could happen. But not now. I just want him to be happy, to find love, absolutely, because he deserves the best. And I do wish him the best, because he deserves it. So now I know we're not going to go back together, but I just want to make the world aware that what happened to me could be avoided. I know that not everyone is suitable for the HRT, but at least get your hormones checked and see what's happening to you, and don't let it drag on like I did, because I ruined my life. I ruined my ex-husband's life, and I'm sure my family and friends were miserable as well. And life is too short.
Jane, thank you so much for telling us your story and laying your heart bare with that story. I'm sure it will help, even if it only helps one person, but it'll help many, I'm sure. Thank you for that, Jane.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity as well. It's much appreciated.
Thanks, Jane. I want to bring in Dawn now. Dawn, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Dawn, tell me your story.
Oh, my story. I'm 42 now. And I suppose when I was 28, 29, I suppose, like the previous lady, noticed a change in my mood. Obviously, 28, 29, you just put it down to your hormones. But then I started to get hot flushes. Like, I could actually see myself getting red I could see it rising in me from my chest up to my neck. This would happen kind of during the day and during the night. Myself and my partner had talked about starting a family. And obviously we started trying, things weren't happening, so went to my doctor. She, you know, did all the usual checks and everything else. No reason why you can't have a family. So continued to try. After about 12 months then, we decided that we'd go to a consultant in Dublin. And he ran various tests and said, no reason why either of you can't get pregnant, you're both perfectly healthy. He gave me a prescription for Clomid, I think it was called, and said to come back in 6 weeks. Came back in 6 weeks, did some more tests. Nope, still nothing happening. Keep trying. At this stage, we were handing out hundreds of euro every time we saw the consultant. And I think after about 4 or 5 trips, I remember coming home in the car and I said to him, I can't do this anymore. I physically can't put myself through this. Every single time we go up, thinking he's going to say, right, this is what's happening, so we need to do this. There never seemed to be a solution. It was always just, stay going.
And
stay
what,
going.
Was there a discussion about you possibly
never.
Being... Never.
Never.
It was never mentioned.
Never. Never, ever. I suppose because of my age, they never considered that this might be the problem.
But
you
had an illness earlier, had you not,
yeah,
that may have contributed?
Yeah. I had skin cancer in 2005. And I would have been on an interferon treatment for about 12 months. But again, it was never looked at as maybe an issue that might affect my fertility.
When did you finally get to hear what might be going on?
Got to the stage where I was talking to my mum about it, and she had a neighbour. And this lady had attended a clinic in Cork, a fertility clinic in Cork. And she couldn't speak highly enough of them. So I rang and I made an appointment and they did blood tests and they did scans. And within an hour of doing the tests and the scans, they told me I was perimenopausal. One appointment.
That simple.
And I was coming home in the car and it was kind of like, right, I'm relieved in a sense. I know what the problem is. But in another sense, I can't have children there. You know, so it really kind of brought home a lot of realities. And I think I cried the whole way home from Cork that day, but it was like, right, okay, at least I know. I know what's wrong. I know what's been happening to me. Do you know that sort of a way? So,
but the good news is you did and you do have
yes.
children.
The good news is we saved away and we said we'd try IVF. We'd give it one go and see what happened. So we attended the Sims Clinic in Clonskee in Dublin and we had egg donation and I conceived twins, one boy and one girl. Yeah. There were four in December gone and they're just two little miracles.
So it is yeah. a happy ending. But
it is.
For you, your health, you're still dealing
yeah,
with
like
these issues.
I'd still, I suppose, get the odd hot flush. It's the tiredness, headaches, aches and pains. My body feels more than a 42-year-old's body probably should. Now, I know I have two four-year-olds, but, you know, I feel if I bang myself, I tend to bruise easier. I'm just tired all the time. You know, and, like, I suppose when my mother always said, oh, don't go on HRT. She had such a bad experience on it when she went on it that I never went on it. But I think I'm going to call my doctor and make an appointment and talk to somebody because, I mean, I shouldn't be as tired as I am my age.
You've been dealing with this, as you say, your twins are 4 years old now.
Yeah.
I can't imagine raising twins, which I've done myself, with those symptoms, it's tough going. It must be tough going.
It is tough going. And like it does, like when you wake up in the morning and you wake up in bad form and you've no reason for being in bad form, you can't explain your mood. You don't know why you're in that. You nearly get yourself into a worse mood because you're in a bad mood because you don't understand why you've woken up that way. It's just, but your body is just all over the place.
Listening to Joe last week and all those stories that were broadcast last week, this has actually made you rethink where you're going.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, no, I've rang my doctors and I'm waiting on an appointment now just to talk to someone and, you know, see what my, I know HRT is not suitable for everybody, but there may be something there that might help me,
okay.
I suppose, feel better about myself and about, you know, I suppose my children are fantastic. You know what I mean? My husband's fantastic, but I suppose the tiredness, there has to be a better way of dealing with that.
Indeed.
I mean, I eat well, I get 8 hours sleep every night. It's not that I'm not sleeping. My kids are great sleepers as well, so I haven't even got that excuse, do you know?
Yeah.
It's just my body, I suppose, my hormones or lack thereof.
Okay. Okay. Well, look, Dawn, we wish you the very best of luck with that. We might hear back from you if you're feeling better down the line.
Yeah.
I would be dying to hear how you get on. But we'll leave that one there. I want to take a break. We'll stay with this after these.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia eSoul. Going electric? Stop wondering and start driving. The Kia eSoul with a range up to 452 kilometres.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And I want to go now to Anne. Anne, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
I see on my screen here that you were in tears listening to this programme last Wednesday.
Yeah, I was on my way shopping last week and I was listening to the girls telling their stories and I was like every one of them I kept saying to myself, that's me. That's exactly what I'm going through. And every one of them was like listening to a mirror of myself because all their symptoms was exactly what I was going through. So I ended up having to pull the car over because I got so upset. Like I was overwhelmed. And I remember one of the girls mentioned the Facebook page. So what I did when I composed myself, I went onto the Facebook page, the Irish Menopause. The Irish Menopause page, and I sought some advice from a couple of the girls on there because basically my story is in my late 30s I had to have a hysterectomy because we had 13 miscarriages and
Anne, 13 miscarriages.
Yeah, we had 13 miscarriages. Sorry, I'm going to get set now. Yeah, we had two perfectly healthy children and then we wanted to expand our family and I had 13 miscarriages. So after having a lot of meetings with my gynae, because of having so many miscarriages and all the DNCs, my womb and cervix was just in bits, basically. So she had recommended then that I had to have a hysterectomy. So I was in my late 30s and had the hysterectomy, and then about 6 months afterwards, I was put on HRT because I was starting to get flushes. And I was on HRT up until about 2 years ago. I'm 52 now. So up until about 2 years ago, I had to go to my GP to get my prescription renewed. And the day I went in, there was a locum on. So she just sat me down and she asked me what I wanted to get. So I told her I needed to get my HRT prescription renewed. And she looked at the screen and she just said, "What? You're on HRT 12 years. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, that has to stop today. I'm not renewing your prescription." And I presumed because she was the doctor, I should have taken her advice. And I kind of felt a little bit intimidated as well, because she scared me a lot with cancer stories, you know, the risk of getting cancer from being on HRT, and the fact that I was on it for 12 years, I was at a higher risk. So she said, as I'm on today, I'm not renewing your prescription for HRT. So anyway, I came out of the surgery, came home. And then I was worried that, I was going to get cancer because I was on it for the 12 years. And
how long ago was that, Anne?
Almost 2 years ago she took me off it.
Right. And you must have been worried, though, because you knew what it felt like when you weren't on HRT. Were you worried about the consequences or the symptoms?
Yeah, I was really worried because initially when I had the hysterectomy, I kind of had a few of the symptoms, but was put on HRT. And I was worried then the fact that I was so much older now, the fact that I was 50 at the time. But I just trusted her because I felt she was the doctor. She knew what she was talking about. So I was kind of like, okay, well, I'll go with it because she's told me this. And then I was absolutely terrified I was going to get cancer. So basically within 3-4 days of being off the HRT, I cannot express this enough. It was literally like somebody hit me with a train. My whole body, my life was crumbling down around me. Initially it was the hot flushes, the insomnia, the tiredness. I can't even explain the tiredness to somebody. It's like you get up out of bed in the morning, let's say at 8 o'clock. By 9 o'clock, all you want to do is get back into bed because you physically cannot do anything with the tiredness. It's debilitating. It's just like somebody has taken the batteries out of your body and you're running on empty. That's how bad it is. And then over time, then the other symptoms was my hair starts to go really coarse. My skin was starting to get hard and dry, and the anxiety was absolutely horrendous. I completely took myself away from being in any situation to be with friends. I'd make up any excuse not to be there because the anxiety was so bad. And this is the way I've been living now for the last 2 years, and my confidence is at an all-time low. So
take us back to Wednesday. You're in the car. You've Googled the Facebook page. Made contact with others. What did you do then?
So then I just got so upset. When I came home again from shopping, I got upset again because somebody had advised me to ring my GP again. And I was like, "But sure, they've taken me off." And in my head, I was saying, "They've taken me off, but she's going to tell me no." And anyway, I rang my GP and I got a consultation for a couple of hours later, and she rang me back and I just started crying. I said, "I can't continue the way I'm going." I said, "I really feel so unhappy. I'm so tired." And I told her all this. And I said, "Is there no way I can go back onto HRT?" And she said, "But who took you off the HRT?" And I said, "I'm off the HRT nearly 2 years now. Because I went in to get renewed a couple of years ago and the locum wouldn't put me back on it. She told me I wasn't allowed to be on it. I was on it too long." And she said, my GP said, "Well, what was her reason for that?" And I said, "I don't know." And she just told me I was on it far too long. She said, "But Anne, you can be on it." And then I just burst out crying again. And I said, "I really can go back and hit your teeth." She said, "Yeah, of course you can. Your body needs this estrogen." So basically, that was it. Then she said, look, I'm going to do a prescription for you and I'm going to email it to your local chemist. She said, and start on them. And she said, stay in contact with me. Let me know how you feel. And if you feel they're working, she said, we can go up a dose, you know, we make a higher dose. So basically, like, my advice is to any woman, listen to your body. Like, nobody has to go through this unnecessarily. Like, only I listened to the, I took the advice of the locum, silly. Like, I'm a grown woman. I should have known better. I should have listened to my body and I should have questioned her and I didn't. So, like, to any woman going through this, go. And even if it means changing your GP or going to a menopause specialist, go and take care of yourself. Because if you don't take care of yourself, nobody else will.
And you got a prescription. Are you back on it? Did you pick up that prescription?
Did I? What? I was in the car first thing Thursday morning because it was late on Wednesday evening when I had the consultation with the GP. So very early Thursday morning, I hopped in the car, went to my local chemist, got the patches and put it on me straight away. Now, I know it's going to take a few months for it to kick in, but I can't tell you the relief that I have.
Oh, I can hear it in your voice. I can hear it in you, Anne.
Yeah, it's like, I know it don't work overnight, but like in my head and in my heart, I know in 3 months or 6 months' time, I'm going to be back to the Anne I was 2 years ago.
God, and I mean, I just, like, you have been through like 13 miscarriages. I can't even imagine the strength you must have to put yourself back together again after each and every one of those, and then go through the hysterectomy and then have that horrific experience and have that horrific experience through COVID when anxiety levels were through the roof anyway. I mean, you're some woman, Anne, to be here to tell us this.
Well, no, I'm not. Like, I have a brilliant hobby as well and my two children are amazing. But it was, like, I just felt I was hard done by, like, the fact that we had lost the 13 babies and then I was catapulted straight into menopause, and then for this to happen 2 years ago again, I just felt really hard done by. But I don't know. Like, it's been tough. I'm not going to say it hasn't been. It's been easy. It has been very, very tough since, you know, we went through all the miscarriages and everything else. But like, the hysterectomy and the menopause really just knocked me for six. Like, it's just the advice I can give is, listen to your body and go and get seek advice, seek help, because nobody should have to go through what we women are going through. There's no reason for it.
Okay, that is excellent advice, and it goes out loud and clear from this show. Get help, ask the questions, and we will be answering hopefully some of those questions after this break. Anne, thank you so much for calling in with that story.
You're very welcome. Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Bye.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with a Kia e-Niro. Going electric? Stop wondering and start driving. The Kia e-Niro with a range up to 455 kilometres.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And I want to go now to Aoife Ní Oichead. Aoife, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, we're delighted to have you on, Aoife, because you have specialist knowledge that will, I'm sure, help a huge number of women out there. You're a pelvic physiotherapist.
That's right. I'm a pelvic or women's health physiotherapist, Katie. And can I say well done to yourselves, Joe, and the team for raising awareness, you know, for these very difficult symptoms that women find it so hard to talk about. And the women that have been on have been absolutely amazing. And I contacted you, Katie, because just, you know, maybe to raise, you know, and talk about a few more issues that the women, you know, might be interested in hearing about, and it might help them further, in particular in relation to the pelvic floor.
Yes, because, of course, a lot of people maybe associate issues with your pelvic floor with childbirth, natural childbirth, and that is what might cause issues down the line. But that's not just it, is it?
Yes, exactly. A lot of people think it's all to do with having children. And, you know, that is true. It is to do with that. But also even pregnancy itself, even women that might have cesarean section, they're not protected from pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. Even younger women, we see a lot of teenagers here. We see men as well, Katie. But just to say, the biggest cohort of patients that we see are in the age group of 40, 50 and 60. So very much the perimenopausal, menopausal and postmenopausal age group.
And what do you say to those women? And if, first of all, what are the symptoms? The symptoms are the most obvious one is incontinence, obviously.
Yes, exactly. And I suppose there's four main categories, Katie. So, you know, if we talk about the bladder, first of all, so leakage from the bladder. You can also have incontinence from the bowel. And I suppose the bowel side is the second main issue. We've heard all about the lack of sleep, the night sweats, and that can really affect your bowel from a sluggishness, from, we call it obstructive defecation, where you have trouble emptying your bowel. So from the bladder, from the bowel, prolapse is another common condition we see, and also sexual dysfunction. And again, I think that was mentioned many times last week, the atrophy, the thinning of the tissues in the vaginal wall, and, you know, the sexual dysfunction.
Okay, so what can people do about this?
Well, the good news is there is so much that can be done. So training the pelvic floor muscles can do so much. It can bring back bulk to the pelvic floor, which really helps with both the bladder function, the filling, storing and emptying from the bladder, the bowel function, the filling, storing and emptying from the bowel, the support there in the pelvis. So, you know, to guard against prolapse, Katie, you know, prolapse is where the organs come down. There's a few different ones. Even a woman that has had hysterectomy can have prolapse. So it's not just the womb we're talking about. The, you know, the bladder and the bowel can also be affected. So when you train these muscles in the base of the pelvis, called the pelvic floor, you know, it guards against and treats a lot of these symptoms, particularly in the ladies in the menopause age group.
And when you say train these muscles?
Yeah. So, yeah, what I mean about those is they are targeted exercises, I suppose, that we do. If I could just give a little quick example, one that yourself, Katie, and all of your listeners will be able to do. If you tighten the muscles around the back passage, imagine that you're trying to hold in wind or gas. You'll be activating your pelvic floor. Now, this is really not pelvic floor muscle training, but it will give you an idea where these muscles are located. And, you know, you need help to train your muscles. I heard an interview this morning on the radio, another topic altogether. You know, it was about the antigen testing. And the person that was on, you know, was speaking about people using the antigen test when they weren't trained to do it and how the results weren't that good. So I could see an analogy there in the pelvic floor. You really need the help of your pelvic physiotherapist to help you train it. You know, getting a sheet of paper, reading something on the, you know, on the internet, it's just not enough. From our research and from our studies, a lot of women are not actually correctly contracting their pelvic floor or training it.
So they think they're doing the divil and all, but actually,
yes,
they might be missing the mark.
Yes, exactly. And with the advent of, you know, new technologies and new diagnostics like ultrasound and MRI, they have really helped the pelvic physiotherapist identify the best training methods. So, for example, Katie, you might be surprised to hear that it's not all about the squeeze. So the squeeze is very important from a strength point of view.
I did think it was all about the squeeze, actually.
I'm sorry. But now, it is good if you can squeeze, you know. And of course, like anything, there are ranges of dysfunction. And what we might do for one person, we mightn't actually do for everybody. But with the tests like ultrasound and MRI, you know, we've seen as pelvic physios the importance of the posterior compartment of the muscles in the pelvic floor in actually lifting your rectum, your vaginal wall, and the neck of your bladder for normal bladder, bowel, and sexual function. So, you know, there's a little bit to it, but it's possible. It's not that difficult. And, you know, we've lots of other skills and tools and techniques as well that we can use, like electrical stimulation, biofeedback, you know, some other things as well.
And are you finding that women are aware enough to understand what's happening?
No. My patients are exactly like the patients that you, the ladies that you had on last week. It was absolutely no surprise to me, Katie, to hear those stories. You know, I am living those stories through my patients every day in my clinic. And, you know, it's heartbreaking. The services really just aren't there and available. You know, now we're very lucky in Galway. You know, there's a great multidisciplinary team here. And, you know, it's sort of a, you know, you need to see, definitely, as everyone has said, start with your GP. But definitely you should consider seeing, you know, a pelvic physiotherapist or accessing some care. And don't forget about the pelvic floor. And Katie, just one point, if I may, as well. And it struck me, a lot of people contacted my clinic, a lot of my patients, a lot of my friends contacted me saying, did you hear this? Isn't it fantastic?
Okay, very quickly, Aoife, we're very close to the end here. Go on.
Oh, yeah, perfect. Just the bone, you know, the protection of HRT for bone, particularly with the women that don't have symptoms. You know, because you don't have symptoms, just don't think you're fine.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Aoife, and thank you. And I'm really sorry to cut across you, but we are right out of time. I want to thank the team. I think that's all we have time for, is it? Stand by for Ray.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.